Welcome back to the Skits and Giggles podcast. I am Pascal, chief instigator of this show and your host. I'm joined by my co-host and the resident engineer, the yin to my yang, the peanut butter to my jelly, Bryson. How's it going today? Have you recovered well from the weekend?
I've recovered, yes. I went for a short recovery run. Thanks for asking. How are you doing?
Yeah, not bad. It was a good time, and I'm still stoked on the whole weekend. So, what's going on? What has been going on?
Well, the snow is starting to melt, now that we've had a few times to go out for a ride together, you know, since the restrictions have been lifting and all, spring's here. We got together and thought about something a little bit different for our listeners. So, yeah, trail's been running pretty good given the conditions. I mean, there's a little bit of snow at the top, but we've been rolling through and getting our skids, getting our giggles on. Well, maybe not skidding, but we're getting our giggles on. So we've had some good times. We've met up some buddies as well, and I've also made some new acquaintances on the trails. We even got to meet some of our listeners, so that was a big highlight. We're taking the opportunity today to talk about what we've been doing recently and, maybe a little bit of what we learned, a little bit of what we were like mulling over those times. And we actually got some listener feedback in person as well as over the channels. And yeah, let's just take some time today to talk about those things. Before we get into it, let's just get the business out of the way. So, normally you can find us on the Skits and Giggles Instagram page. We love to hear from you guys. And just to send us a direct message, a DM. Also, our website is in the link below. So visit us. And if you have any comments, questions, or anything like that, send us an email. Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, you can find us, and we're doing this for you, so we really like to get in touch. So, back to mountain biking. Pascal, why don't we talk a little bit about the last two weekends? I'm not a native to Switzerland, so, and contrary as you are, you definitely know these areas at least by the names and by the general areas and cultures better than I do. So how about you just give us a layout about where we were, what we did, and go.
We got to ride on the back of some listener feedback, actually, in two really cool locations. 2 weeks ago, we went to an area close to Lucerne where we've never been before. A very cool zone just above the lake, fantastic views. So it wasn't quite spring yet. There was still some snow at the top. So around 1,000 meters was the snow line. So, you know, the very first descent was a bit spicy with wet roots and such. So the day cleared up in the end, and it was a fantastic day. Unfortunately, we had to cut it short because of some timing issues, but it was a good day nonetheless. And last weekend, it was a trip that we had planned for quite some time. And the original plan was to go to ride with a sick guide in the French Euro region. But unfortunately, due to COVID restrictions and, travel restrictions, etc., we decided that was not such an essential trip to cross the border, so we stayed closer to home, and we went to the Chablais Vaudoise, which is an area just to the east of Lake Geneva, pretty close to the main mountain ranges, so generally has some great weather early on. There's some infrastructure for shuttling this time of the year, and we got the group together, former guests of the podcast, good friend of ours, Yeti, so Esteban Zimmermann, he was part of the crew, and of course Bryson and myself were there, and there were some other people that we met up along that trip that made it worthwhile. So maybe Bryson, throw it back to you. I mean, what do you think of the two trips?
So first off, the area near Luzern, I know that there's a fantastic trail network there. I've been hiking there a couple times, and I've also just seen a lot of mountain bikers in this area. Not exactly in the specific place that we were, but I did ride around a part of the lake, and I saw mountain bikers. And then when I went to check out the Pilatus, I also saw mountain bikers everywhere, just heading in every direction. So I knew there were some trails. And generally, I kind of have come to figure out in Switzerland, wherever there's like a cogwheel train or a Seilbahn, so like a gondola, you're going to find guys riding their bikes down because, it's just, you're going to find some trail cut up by an animal or a farmer or a smuggler or whoever it is. And generally, it's going to lead to maybe like a little secret location that somebody cut in and, people find or they hear about through their network. I was really surprised to find the terrain there that resembled some trails from kind of like Squamish, Whistler, Sea to Sky type riding, where you find more moist dirt mixed with some root. Typical for Switzerland, the straight down fall line descents, a little bit off camber. So that was really nice. We were with a pretty solid crew, one guy who knew the area very well, and then everyone else who was just seemed like on their game that day. So I was really happy to ride with a solid crew. Last weekend, we went to the Chablais, and I didn't know so much about it, and I chose to not really do so much to educate myself because that's just my style. Sometimes I just like to throw myself into these things. Fantastic riding as well. I didn't expect the variety. Actually, I couldn't expect anything, really. I didn't really know anything. But actually, it was really funny because when we rolled into town, like in the middle of the first day, I was thinking like, hey, I've been here before, actually. And actually, on a road trip with my significant other, we had passed through this city before, and I noticed this area, and actually we stopped for a sandwich. And then I had this idea of like, aha, now I know where in Switzerland I am because I drove through here and I had to navigate my way across Switzerland on that road trip. So again, I found a lot of interesting varied terrain, from dry, dusty, slippery chutes to a little bit of something that I could find maybe on Vancouver Island, where it was like the green room, moss everywhere, not such a steep grade, lots of small turns weaving through trees, intermittent root sections with some fabled loam, and I had a lot of fun there. They have a very big network, and as you mentioned, a shuttle, a type of shuttle. So again, wherever you find these trains, you're going to find guys who want to use them to take their bike up to the top. And that's primarily the mode of transportation that we used that last weekend.
Oh yeah, no, I was surprised myself a little bit. I mean, of course, I knew that there is, of course, in Switzerland, in many places, you have these mountain trains, and most of them allow bikes and other. But it was just cool to see in that area to what extent bikers use this mountain train to access terrain that is. Pretty exciting this time of the year. I mean, I guess, it's back end of April right now as we're recording this. And, most bike parks, certainly in the Alpine, they are still closed. So let's say the shuttle opportunities, apart from having a shuttle vehicle, like a truck or a bus or something available, are pretty limited. So I guess that's also why it was so busy over the weekend, is, people that know that and they show up, and the circumstances on the train they were certainly quite interesting, with including stacking bikes rows on top of rows, and having bikes in the passenger compartments and stuff like that. And the interesting thing is, I mean, just as I prepared a little bit for the trip, I mean, we were quite a big group. We had a local friend of ours that that was doing some of the guiding, and I was surprised to find the variety, as you said, between these steep chutes and a kind of subalpine terrain, deep forests, and all of that. But what I found most interesting is the point that was most accessible is just a quick public service announcement. We played back this episode before we went live with it to a friend that guided us in the Chablais region, and he preferred us not naming the specific locations where we rode. So that's why whenever we talk about the exact location, you hear the sound of a beautiful skid like this. And after that, we just continue on with our conversation. Thanks for your understanding. You have these trails that are, carved into the hillside or built into the hillside. And there's so many variations, so many different ways that you can link up the different trails, the different descents. So it was just a lot of fun. Of course, we were super lucky this weekend. It was fantastic. It hadn't rained or any moisture in over a week. It was warm, so the trails were actually already almost like it was in peak summer season, so quite dusty. The vertical you can do in that area was quite something. So with one single lap of the train, depending on which area you went to, so say that's about 800 meters vertical, and the other side towards it's more like 1,200 meters of vertical. So that's actually some decent elevation that you can get in at this time of the year. But also the valley floor is relatively low in the grand scheme of things. But I mean, coming back to the weekend before, I mean there as well. I mean, we have to say that unfortunately. Yes, we observe that there's gondolas and mountain trains in the Lucerne area, but in Lucerne, the canton of Lucerne itself, you're not allowed to take bikes on any of the mountain infrastructure. So that was first thing in the morning was a big pedal up from the parking lot and up to the snow line. So all of what Bryson had been saying about spring is here and the snow is gone, that wasn't quite... wasn't quite a situation when we showed up in Lucerne.
To our surprise. I didn't expect to climb that high that day. Actually, I had no idea what we were doing. I just showed up unprepared like usual. But that's my style. I think anyone who's ridden with me has come to learn that. But I persevere. I made it up. I had a couple gels and then...
A couple cramps,
It's now nothing... nothing you won't normally experience with me.
Yeah, but I mean, the interesting thing was, and it's just the geography of that area, is that, in the morning, early morning when we got started, so yes, we rode up to the snow line, and it was obviously very wet and chilly, of course. by about lunchtime, when we traversed over to this other area called Loppo, there that's sun exposed, and it was dry relatively quickly. It was as I said, it was already almost dusty, kind of more like a Ligurian coast or south of France kind of feeling in the sun on the rock. And there's again some big downhills there, and some good fun, of course. And So maybe summarize those 2 weekends. What were your highlights, Bryson?
They're kind of like the shakeup to kind of see where I left off from last year. I'm not far off from where I left off, I think, especially after last weekend. It taught me a little bit like, hey, make sure you check your fork pressure because if you're running too low, you're going to be fork diving and losing a lot of traction, which I was on the first day. But I was happy I kept my one winter tires on because riding into mixed conditions, it's nice to have a familiar tire. So I've been riding this shorty, since October or so. When we went to Russian Pass, and I've just got used to the way it grips and the way it's the predictability of it, and then of course the pressure. So this really helped. I think I by the end of this past weekend, I'm up to speed with where I left off last year, and also the stoke. Like the stoke went through the roof. I couldn't stop smiling. So, the highlight was I'm ready to start the season again.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, it was also a very very cool crew, quite a progressive crew, and kind of like pushing each other on, and of course some pretty challenging terrain. And I think for me personally, the highlights were. Yeah, I mean, the first day, the riding with the local and, seeing some of the stuff that he's been working on and then taking us to these places has been very, very interesting. Very, very different from what we ride normally. So, I mean, here in Zurich, of course, yes, you have some elevation, but, we're talking about 200-300 meters of vertical. Yes, we have some steep and slippery and muddy stuff, but we don't have, 500-700 meters of vertical in 2-3 minutes, so not that steep, and of course like the just the scenery in that area with you're so close to the Alps, you still have the snowy peaks, you're staring at those mountains all the time, and you're just yes, it's nice and warm. It's like 20 degrees, shorts and t-shirt, like all is good. It's dusty. And then you look up and it's like, oh, wow, there's still snow. And when you get off the train at the top, there's still in the shady spots, there's still some snow left. And there's the odd mud puddle that, just to remind yourself that, it's only April and not July, but apart from that, it was just it was just fantastic. And
we arrived at the Apres bike, and there were ski tours sitting down for beers as well.
Oh, absolutely!
At the outdoor this outdoor area we had found, and then also the guy who volunteered to guide us for the first day, he was telling us he's going touring the next day. Like he couldn't get enough. His season's not finished yet.
No, for sure, for sure. Well, I mean, I guess this area is also very close to the glaciers and stuff like that. So there's a little bit of extra winter season coming along in the spring. But I mean, as you say, that it was funny. We were sitting. We had our accommodation in, which is roughly 1,200, 1,300 meters, and it's right in the middle of this mountain zone. And we were it was 50-50 between the bikers that were coming up from the valley and riding in the valley and the skiers coming down from skiing up on the mountain and still enjoying the snow at the end of April.
Were there any lowlights, Pascal?
Oh well, yeah. There was definitely some low light. I mean, luckily for me, it wasn't personally affected so much. But Telmo, one of the guys in our group, he has this thing where he's trying to introduce his bike to a tree, and trying to make them friends, and then the tree denies the love and rejects the bike and then breaks stuff off. And in this particular case, it snapped the rear derailleur hanger, which is not a great thing to happen out on the trail in exposed terrain. So I would say the lowlight was standing somewhere in the forest on the mountainside, waiting for Tamil to convert his 12-speed mountain bike into a single speed at first, until he figured out that it doesn't quite work the way he set it up. And then he went chainless, which of course for the rest of the group meant that you know, there was some pushing required, or some pulling, as it was the next day. And you can check that out on our Instagram feed. I posted a video of me pulling Telmo with a spare tube attached to my frame and his handlebars. But yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it's maybe to summarize, it's just, you know, it always the display of power of the mountain when it, you know, you try to convince the mountain that you have things under control, and then he just throws it right back in your face. And I think Telmo got the short end of that stick this time around. And unfortunately, we also, you know, we tried to find a derailleur hanger for him, for his bike. And you know, we weren't quite as lucky to sort that out on a weekend. So on Sunday, we pushed and pulled him along so he could still keep riding. And, you know, I think that was then also the positive. It was in terms of the crew, it was cool that we all stuck together. And, you know, we let go of some extra riding, but, you know, we could all stay together and have a good time. And I think we had a good laugh in the end. So
definitely,
it was all good.
It increased the amount of smiles for sure. It was funny.
For sure.
Yeah, like no one better than Telmo to have something like this happen.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Well, talking about having riding buddies, we also on Sunday ran into our old friend of the podcast, Robin. And it was just a very coincidence. I was sitting on this train waiting for it to leave, and I hear Bryson. And I look over because I recognize his voice, and I see him. I say, "Oh my God." Unfortunately, like, the train was packed, and I just yelled back to him, "Are you going up?" And he's like, "I think so." And I was like, "Nope."
Yeah, I'm a dick. The train was pretty packed at that stage.
Horrible. But he did miss that one.
No, he actually made it on.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Surprised on the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Surprise news.
And then speaking of Robin, we have a listener question from the one and only. He wanted to know, how do you prepare for a trip like this into a zone that you haven't ridden and terrain you haven't experienced before? What do you do in terms of bike setup? And are you going to carry some emergency supplies, or additional things that you normally don't carry on, say, local rides, or, you know, special missions that you do, you know, for example, every year we go to Russian Pass. So, or maybe even your semi-local Davos. So what's something a little bit different that you do?
Well, actually, I think the main thing for me is that, well, I have two bikes, and one is a winter bike, and that is mostly ridden at home, and one is a summer bike. The summer bike is also a pretty burly mountain bike. It is set up for alpine riding, it's set up for racing. And when I set up to build this bike, I you know, chose the components to make it as you know, replaceable as possible, so I can find all the consumables. I can find them pretty much wherever I go. So let's say the brake pads, or, you know, the bearings, or the bottom bracket, or you know, anything that could go wrong, I could find that locally. So even in the most remote mountain bike shop, you could find whatever you needed. And anything that I couldn't find in a bike shop, I would usually carry myself, and that would include things like, you know, as Telmo learned the hard way, because he admitted that he had three derailleur hangers at home and didn't bring them. I usually bring a derailleur hanger. Speaking of general setup for a trip, I mean, it's just common sense things. I do before a big riding weekend, I do, you know, a full bolt check on the whole bike. I check all the consumables. So I make sure that my brake pads are, that have enough material on them. I make sure that my rotors are still okay and in a decent shape. I make sure my gears are okay and in a decent shape. But then, depending on where I go, I also do a little bit of recce in terms of, what kind of terrain am I riding? Is it more rocky? Is it more forest? Is it more whatever it is, right? Muddy, for example. And then that would maybe tilt my choice one way or the other. I have kind of my happy place in terms of tires and general setup. And in the summer, I generally run the same setup. Robin, that we are currently talking about, he also, managed to convince me to try out a new set of tires. So his favorite Onza Porcupine RCs, which I'm currently running on my bike. And, they fit the bill very, very nicely in terms of robustness that I would expect from a tire if I take it to the Alpine. So it has a sturdy casing. So that means it's very robust for, over rocks and hard big roots and stuff like that. So, the braking traction is what it is. So, I always say, primarily you want to have a strong casing, and then, the tread of the tire is kind of just, you like it or you don't. And particularly with the Onza, I have to say, like, the casing it feels fantastic. So it's kind of allows to run relatively low pressure, but it still has quite a lot of side support, which is something I really, really like. And the tread pattern is something I need to get used to a little bit more. I mean, I've been riding my other tires for 2-3 years. So I've only been riding the Onzas for 2 months. So there's still some catching up to do. The other thing, if I know when I ride somewhere that's very, very steep, it's just small details you can change on your bike, is something like the height of your cockpit, so like your bar height. And that's actually also something that that I noted on the train. And it reminded me of a bike check that I read on Pink Bike a little while back with Jack Moyer. And one of the top comments was asking, so Jack, how high would you like to run your handlebars? And the answer was yes.
Or was it yeah, mate?
And so the thing is that I noted is when we met our friend that was guiding us on Saturday, he was running his handlebars very high, and then we met his friend, and then the first thing I noted is that he runs an uncut steerer. He wants a positive rise stem, and he has like a 38 mil handlebar on top of it. So, like, has his handlebars basically on his belly, like the height of his belly button. So that's something you can do to cope with like very steep terrain. And the other thing, which actually I noted on your bike, Preston, as well, is that the thing you can do is run your brake levers higher. So just as a it helps. I personally feel it helps with just the angle on your wrists and just getting the proper grip on your brake levers in very steep terrain. And I would say Chablis Vaudoise would qualify in most instances as very steep terrain. So that was my monologue. So Bryson, how did you do anything special on your bike for the trip?
Well, originally I was anticipating this being like a very shuttle-ish type of weekend. So I was going to bring I also don't have only one bike. So I was going to bring my other bike, which is set up and built more along the lines of the bike you described. So something for more rockier alpine, more robust, kind of, but definitely aimed towards just shuttling. It's got a good gear selection, but it's not a flyweight. So it's really stable and kind of just takes the beating well. However, after talking with some of the group members that we decided to meet up with, it was clear to me that this wouldn't be like, this would be a lot more of a pedal day than I had originally anticipated. So I went to my go-to normal trail bike. And when just a general thing I like to do is I'd never really changed my setup too drastically. However, a caveat to that is I am continuously experimenting with my setup. So I'm doing like really...
You're the tickler. Just true. Admit to it.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe we should explain to the listener what tickling means. You'd like to tickle your bike. What does that mean?
I think the instigator needs to give the explanation.
Well, what Bryson likes to do is explore the possibilities of a bicycle, and that it can include things like, as we already discussed, the angular setup of his brake levers. It can include changing organic brake pads for sintered brake pads, mixing organic and sintered brake pads on the inside as well as on the outside.
Okay, can, cool kids are doing it.
And so it can be, it's basically a continuous experimentation with the ideal state of your bicycle. What it means for the people and friends that are riding with you is a lot of waiting time, because you generally need to do that right in this instant on the trail. When you have a train to catch usually, or a bus, and that can lead to some frustration. But I must admit, you have gotten a lot better over the years. So kudos to you. I think my personal Waterloo in that regard was the first time when we went to Davos and you had a rental bike that you needed to improve right then and there. And we were standing in the pouring rain on a mountainside in falling temperatures. And I was just wanted to get off the mountainside, and you just needed to, fiddle with your brake pads or whatever it was. I can't even remember, but so that was that. So that was the tickling intermezzo. Back to you, Bryson.
Yeah, in all fairness, that rental bike really had a brake problem, and it wasn't sufficient. So something needed to be done. It was really terrible. I've learned a little bit. I've learned to not let people wait for me to do these things. And, you've kind of given me the guiding light on that aspect. So thank you so much for that. Back to how I had my bike. So, I just kind of like to have my bike as familiar as possible, because, what's wrong with that? So that's what I do. I just kept my bike the way it was, how I normally ride it the previous weeks. One caveat is the brake levers, actually, because normally I don't ride in such steep terrain. Actually, I pretty much avoid it. I just don't find that much, really. And also, it's not my idea of like absolute fun. So, on a group ride, when we all have like spirits high, we're all giggling and slashing turns through these like dry leaf Chablais, it's amazing. So, I got a great tip from you guys, like turn up the levers a bit, because you're adjusting the angle as you're going steep. And, all of a sudden, like I had a lot less arm fatigue and hand fatigue and all these things, and braking was acting better. I was able to manage to maneuver the bike a lot easier because I wasn't so fatigued. And I think generally I was able to survive the day a little bit better because of this slight, tip or modification I was given. So There's that. Yeah, I like to basically run the tires. Like, you know, when you're familiar with something, run it. Run what you brung. As we've been going on our adventures, I have picked up a couple tips from you. So definitely energy management is like a big point for me now. I used to get to the top of a climb and like lay down. I think anyone who's been with me, prior to coming.
I have photographic evidence of that.
Yeah, I still do it on occasion, but I mean, I like it. It's nice. It's actually a really good feeling. Like, there's like a little release, you know? And it just helps me get up back on the bike and feel fresh. So I don't know if it's a mental thing or it's just a really physical thing. But having food, having enough water, these are things I'm really keen on working on now that, you know, understanding a little bit more from you because you come from a very performance aspect and that's helped me a lot. So kudos to you, Pascal. Thank you so much. And as well as all the other people I've ridden with who have given me power bars and their extra water bottles. I tried to secure a extra derailleur hanger prior to the trip. But they weren't in stock, but I knew that because
I took all of them. That's why.
Yeah. And I knew because we share the same frame manufacturer and basically the same frame, I knew that there would be at least one somewhere in your kit bag. And, that gave me a little bit of, insurance.
Extra confidence.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing, I want to talk about a little bit is, because of course, you know, there's if you follow the bike media, you know, current bike media a little bit, then there's this this concept of the mullet bike. So what that means, again, you know, bringing it back to feedback that we got from listeners, we throw in the old jargon from time to time. So we take this opportunity to clarify some of that. So what does a mullet mean? A mullet means running mixed wheel sizes. So that means running a larger wheel size in the front. So for example, a 29-inch wheel in the front and running a smaller wheel in the back. So in Bryson's case, a 27.5-inch or a 650B wheel in the back. So what does that do? Of course, on the one hand, it allows for a little bit more clearance on your bum to maneuver a bike around if you're not quite such a tall person. What it also does is does make the bike a little bit more playful, typically. And it also slackens the bike out a little bit. So that was the excursion for the mixed wheel size. So for the listener, Bryson usually runs a mixed wheel size trail bike. Also on this trip, he brought his mulleted trail bike, and so I just wanted to know how did all of that work out. I mean, I think the issue was around some pressure in the fork and having a little bit too much dive in the front when it got really, really steep.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. When you don't have your suspension set up properly, you lose a little bit of traction, a little bit of control, a little bit of security and confidence. And on the first day, I didn't make the point to check the pressure because I just assumed it was where I left it back home. And maybe, you know, over some time, since I haven't checked it in maybe a couple of weeks, the pressure has decreased a little bit. I could also contribute it to us being like, I don't know, 700 to 500 meters higher than we normally ever go. So maybe there's some kind of some altitude differential at work. I don't exactly know. And I didn't test anything, but I did find a lower pressure. And once I had brought that pressure back up to where I normally have it, I found the same confidence and control traction that I would come to expect from my setup.
Okay. Well, it's just generally, I mean, you know, as a general remark here, I mean, you've been running the mixed wheel size on a trail bike, which is not normally something we see a lot, you know, outside of, so for example, where mixed wheel size is very common is in the downhill World Cup, for example, quite a few riders are running mixed wheel sizes. Very few on the Enduro World Series are running mixed wheel sizes. And so, yeah, on trail bikes, you really don't see it that often. So maybe can you explain a little bit what the main benefits are for you personally?
Yeah, number one would be like cerebral flexibility. So actually, the story goes, one day I was up on the Utliberg and I saw the Yeti, Esteban, for the listeners, and he was charged. I was coming around the corner and he dived into the trail, and I was like, oh, Yeti. So I like yelled at his name. He didn't hear me. So I just chased him. So basically I chased him around this trail. He just lost me. So I like couldn't keep up, but I was running as fast as I could down this trail or riding. And I got to the bottom and basically just, there was a bunch of roots and, blew out the tire, cracked the carbon rim, and had to source a replacement pretty quickly before a bike trip that I was going on. So I just bought a 650B rear wheel because I thought it would be kind of funny to try that. Luckily, our frame has a flip chip, so I was able to flip that into the high setting, which actually brought everything back up to the stock dimensions. And I've been happy ever since.
Okay. But you're also a proponent of the concept of underforking. So what that means, underforking, so typically a bike is overforked, so you have more fork travel on your front wheel and less on your rear wheel. So let's say a typical example for a trail bike would be, you know, 150 millimeter front travel and 140 millimeters of rear wheel travel. Our dear friend Bryson here, he's currently running a 160 millimeter rear wheel travel combined with a 140 millimeter front wheel travel. So what's up with that? What's the rationale here?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I just took that 140 mil travel fork off another bike, when I was building this bike up, and, I was just so excited to build this bike that I just took some parts. I got a bunch of new parts, but I took this old fork, which is, you know, old reliable Fox 36. I love this fork. I've had it for a while, and I mean, it's a great fork. I jive with it really well, and I just threw it on there just to see what would happen. The handling wasn't horrible at all. I was still riding pretty much the same way I was riding the bike previous, and it felt really good, so I went with it. Actually, when I did the first swap, so when I originally put that fork on the bike, it was 130. And I had a de-stroked rear shock. So I actually had 130 front, 140 rear. And then I eventually over time upgraded, not the fork, but the rear shock. And so I went to a full stroke shock, which brought me 160 enduro travel. And I left the fork the way it was just to see what it would be like. It being the winter season, I was going to leave it as the 140 travel so that I wouldn't have such a slack head angle, because I was afraid that the slack head angle would wash out a little bit easier, and having a steeper head angle, I would have a little bit more traction on the front. And I could manage that because the reach of the bike is pretty satisfactory for my size, and I was very comfortable with that. And the minimal change in the reach is, yeah, negligible. So I rode the 140 millimeter travel fork through the winter, and I've continued to ride it, and I actually haven't found such a need to increase the travel or have a longer travel fork, even though I have a spare fork that would suit the bike at the correct travel length. I just found that I really liked the way the bike handles that way. And, it's just, again, part of my whole experimental theme. I'll even admit to it, listeners. There's quite a few times where I'm on a ride and someone will look at me and say, "Hey, you don't have pins on your pedal." And I actually did that.
Neuroplasticity.
Oh, that's it. Neuroplasticity or cerebral flexibility. No. So what I did was I removed the pins from one side of the pedal. It was originally the idea was that I don't normally get pedal strikes, but you know, when you're riding in sort of a rough terrain where you are not in full control of the bike and you're letting it dance, sometimes that pedal comes a little bit lower and it is going to touch a rock or touch a root. And if you had a pin there, it's going to grab on that rock or root. And if you didn't, because I'm riding nylon pedals, they will have a chance to slide, really. So this is the original idea. And then I was listening to a few podcasts and just kind of exploring the world as it is. And I understood this idea of neuroplasticity, and it's kind of to set yourself up to learn something different than what you're normally used to. And so I would use this as a answer when someone would ask me, why don't you have pins on one side? Or why do you have pins on only one side of your pedal? And it's for neuroplasticity, of course. Like,
I'm curious. I mean, I've only just recently started using flat pedals again, so maybe I should remove some pins as well to not only save my shoes, but increase my cerebral flexibility.
I have a question for you, Pascal.
Yeah.
Something that I haven't asked you before, but I would really like your take on. So you've noticed that I've made these odd changes. They're not so normal. They're, you know, kind of against the grain or just plain different. And, you know, I'm not a bad rider. And I wouldn't say that the choices that I make necessarily set me back in terms of my riding ability or skill or progression. But I was wondering, as a performance-minded athlete, what's your take on what I'm doing and how it affects my riding and my experience?
Well, I mean, it's, of course, a very different approach, right? Because, you know, let's say as an athlete or someone that cares about performance, so like, you know, traditional sense of getting from point A to point B in the most efficient and fastest way is a different approach, right? Because you want to know, you try out, you know, what kind of works out for you. So you see all these notions and ideas that have been around for decades or whatever. So yes, you should have pins on both sides of your pedals. And it's like, no, you don't necessarily need to, because maybe it adds an additional challenge to your riding and somehow it maybe improves your experience. And, but yeah, so I mean, what I'm trying to say is like, you know, with pondering these questions of, you know, does it work or does it not work? You have a lot more degrees of freedom than, let's say, someone that is just worrying about getting from point A to point B in the fastest and most efficient way. And because, let's say, yeah, pedals is a very good example. And I know, you know, we've talked about it quite a bit. And, you know, as I just said earlier, is I've only just recently started using flat pedals again, is when I'm racing, blowing my feet off the pedals is just not something I want to worry about. But on the other side is, I note right now, after having ridden flat pedals again for, you know, what is it, 2 years or two winters now, that, you know, your foot technique gets much better, you're much more flexible on the bike, you move around much easier because you're not locked down by your clips, etc. So yeah, I think there's, of course, as always, there's two sides to the story. And of course, performance is one. And you know, just trying out and finding out what works for yourself and what allows you to have more fun riding the bike the way you like to ride it. And I think it's all fair game. And, you know, I think, yeah, I keep on listening to you and, you know, one day, and you know, sometimes you find out something that's really cool and really interesting, and I try it out. I mean, the same way as you tried out the higher levers on your brakes. So I think it goes both ways. So sometimes you find something interesting, and sometimes I do. So have an open mind. Try it out.
Yeah, I thought that lever thing was only for French people.
No, that's I think it actually comes from the motor world, but yeah, no, again, you know, as you say, the French people are very, very known. So like Rémy Metayer and Johan Varelli, I think, are the most vocal advocates of the high brake lever position. I run mine still negative, but pretty high, so maybe like, you know, 10, 15 degrees from flat. So, but yeah, I mean, maybe to wrap up and bring it back to our two excursions, Bryson, well, of course, number one, would you go back to those locations?
Oh, yeah. For good. Sure.
That's what I wanted time. To hear.
I got after a few Chablais, I got the hang of this, swinging the bike around and like sliding it sideways. And after we entered some of the steeper ones, I was like, yeah, I got this actually. Because the first one, you know, it wasn't so steep really, but you know, your first Chablais, then you're like, holy cow, I can't stop. Like, you just have to keep going. But the funny thing is, you just stay upright. I mean, okay, some people don't, but, you know, I caught on. And maybe it's my skiing background or just the fact that I'm comfortable with my bike kind of moving around. I started really to have fun and getting used to the bike moving around and using it to control myself, to control my speed and my direction.
So. Okay. And who do you think, you know, taking both locations, so let's say the area close to Lucerne as well as the Chablais, who do you think should be thinking about going there? Would you take a beginner there?
Certainly not. No. I think probably everywhere we ride, I would not take a beginner.
Okay. All right. So what would be the typical profile where you would take that, you know, of a rider that you would take to maybe to Lucerne, let's say?
I would say someone who's been riding maybe like 3 or 4 seasons. Someone who's very comfortable with their bike setup. Someone who doesn't crash every single ride. And someone who has like, you know, their full, like, fanny pack or backpack with the things they need, or at least the things that they think or know that they need to like get a full ride day in and out.
Oh, yeah,
and also sure. Help others if need be.
And yeah, so thinking back to last weekend, I think I've never seen so many downhill bikes in one spot. And I have been to World Cup downhills. I've been to World Championship downhills. I've never seen so many downhill bikes in one spot. So I guess that tells you something about the riding in the area we were over the weekend. And so I guess I would say maybe beginners, not necessarily, but you know, if you're confident trail rider, then there's plenty of those that that go there too. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, there's no other place you want to have a slack head angle. So downhill bike it is.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, maybe to wrap up, the last two weekends, we also have some more listener questions, and we actually have two from one of our UK listeners, no less. You know, we're not doing this necessarily only for Switzerland. We're doing this to talk about mountain biking in Switzerland, but we want to be accessible to anyone, which is why we speak English in this podcast. And so an old friend of mine, mate of mine back from work, JT, he wanted to know, who's faster, you, Pascal, or your co-host? And I got a take on this. Can I go first? All right. Well, I think you don't really care about going fast. You care about having the most fun, finding the funny lines, expressing yourself, of course. And so to quote our dear friend Yeti Esteban, if there's an obvious mainstream, efficient, fast line down a trail, that's not where you find Bryson. Bryson usually likes to do the one that is kind of out there, a little bit different. And for someone riding behind you, sometimes a bit surprising. So What do you got on this?
Well, you know, first of all, I am faster than you. I'm just too scared to go faster than you. To be honest, I am quite afraid of going fast. It's not an easy one for me. I've never been this like guy who can let off the brakes, like death grip, or even just not touch them. So often I'm burning up my rotors, and generally I'm not looking for speed. Like you said, I'm more of a, hey, what can I do with this trail? You know, when we're running or riding some of the routes in Davos, you know, it's like a ridgeline, and you just got to stay on that patch of dirt or else you're done. Yeah,
it's high consequence.
Yeah. Those times I just stay on that section of trail and I ride it and I find the grip points. I like to analyze the trail and see like, okay, should I come faster in this corner? Should I come slower in this corner? Things like this. But when it's kind of more of a forested area, you've got like a patch of roots here, you've got a bunch of dirt, a little bit grass or trees that you can like slalom around. I'm always trying to really cut close to a tree, or if there's like a small hill, I do like a pre-jump, or, you know, just being a little more playful rather than trying to like squash the jump or like boost really high and double or triple a set of doubles or, you know, something like that. I'm more, let's just like flow with the trail and kind of glide.
Yeah.
I hope those weren't too much jargon.
No, not at all. I would just say, I mean, if Bryson wants to go fast, he can, but he chooses not to most of the time. And that's totally fine because I like his riding and it's a lot of fun to watch. So, and it makes him happy. That's what counts.
Yeah, and I think we have a contrast of riding style. So you're fast, and I'm not so fast. But at the end of the day, we arrive at the bottom, have a beer, exactly. And we're still sharing giggles and maybe sometimes a skid.
There you go. I mean, that's actually quite a fitting transition. We have the last one from JT, also a very fitting after the first really really warm weekend trip. What's a great post-ride beer?
Yeah, I'll go first. So I am a big fan of the Fat Tug. And this is my go-to beer when I was in Canada. I haven't found one in Switzerland, but actually I haven't looked because there is a plethora of great beers here. Do you find any great beers? What's your great Swiss beer here?
Oof. I mean, there's... some very good Swiss beers. I think post ride, I'm a big fan of a cold, especially in the summer, of like a cold Weizen beer. So like the wheat beer, and you know, let's say Bavaria, of course, is very very famous for their wheat beers, and they have some fantastic options. But actually, here in Switzerland, we also have some very good ones. And you know, my second home, my spiritual home, Davos, has one of my favorite options, which is the local wheat beer, the Hustrafel from Monstein. It's very, very yummy. It has this citrusy, very refreshing taste. And so this is just one of my favorites. And actually, JT had one of those too, so he should know.
I'm down for one of those.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, I mean, seeing that we don't have a guest today, we thought it would be quite interesting if we went through our regular closing questions with Bryson for a change. So maybe, Bryson, let's hear a little bit about that first bike that got you really stoked on riding.
Yeah, so pretty much all of my bikes get me stoked on riding, got to say, in the beginning. But the first one, which was the original Ride Stoker, was my Norco Fury. Now, this was a URT, so for the jargon, not the for the jargon explanation, we have a unified rear triangle. And basically what that is a very, let's say,
sketchy,
poor design of a rear suspension, where the bottom bracket, and that's where your cranks and your pedals spin, is connected to the same piece of metal that your rear tire is connected to. and then it pivots somewhere above the bottom bracket to create that suspension movement. So basically, it's like you're on a hardtail on the back of your bike, and then the front of your bike is suspended independently from the front wheel and the main triangle. So I know it's a little bit abstract, my definition, but yeah, if you just type in URT mountain bike on the Google, then you will find lots of examples. This ride got me stoked because, it was like my first proper mountain bike. So I wasn't a shop grom, but I did visit the local bike shops in my town quite often. Let's say 2-3, sometimes 4 days a week with my best friend, John. He's actually the one I credit to getting into mountain biking. So thank you, John. He was eyeing up a Kona Fire Mountain, and I was eyeing up the Noco Fury. The reason was I wanted a full suspension mountain bike. Of course, I didn't know anything about mountain bikes, but it had 2.3-inch tires, and I was so stoked that they were like so they're Kenda. I can't remember the brand, the model name, but they were Kendas, and they had like these really aggressive treads on them, and I thought, this is a mountain bike, and it comes with a front disc brake, RockShox Judy TT fork, so I don't know, 80 millimeters of travel or so with elastomers, just kind of a no-name rear coil shock that didn't really have any damping, but you know, it didn't matter. What really stoked the game for me was it all had all the standard sizes for, I mean, I didn't know at the time, but I realized soon after that it all like the steer tube size was the 1 1/8. The wheel size was the, you know, 135 millimeter normal, they call it OLD spacing. Same with the front. It was the standard for mountain bike at the time. And I was able to just fully upgrade the thing. So basically I went from the stock bike to having mixed wheel size. So 26, 24 in the back. I had a junior T fork on the front, so 100, I think it was 160 or 150 millimeters of travel at the time. Chrome one. I had a super riser handlebar, which actually I still have, and it's on my city bike now. I got an aftermarket stem, seat, I think the seat post, the seat post clamp, and the headset are the only things that were stock on the bike before I ripped all those components off and put it onto another frame. And so, yeah, I mean, definitely that bike got me stoked on riding. I was like, so stoked to get new parts, so stoked to shred them. That's where the whole experimentation kicked off with like, let's try a super high rise bar. Let's try double clamp fork. Let's try, you know, mixed wheel sizes. I had no clue on these things. And I also got my first set of race face cranks, which,
OG turbines.
Yeah.
Nice.
Red ones.
All right. Very cool. Cool. Well, I mean, let's then go to the second one. Our signature question. Imagine you're Harry Schedini, bike magician extraordinaire, and you can make riding a bike more awesome for anyone by the stroke of a magic dropper post. What would you do?
You know, before we had guests on the show, I had at least one answer to this that
I would say guest, it's a boilerplate answer.
A guest had used, exactly. But actually, I have a new one. And now, you know, my motto for riding, or one of my mottos for riding, is I love where the bicycle has taken me. And so it's kind of like, you know, not just exactly where it takes me because I'm riding it as a transportation, but to like the sense and feelings where it takes me. So I've gone to a lot of really cool places. I've rode a lot of really cool trails, and I've met a lot of really cool people. And so if I had to thumb that magical dropper post lever and pop that post, I'm going to turn everybody into themselves. That's because there's a lot of great people out there, and everyone should be mixing it up, saying hi to each other, shredding trails together. You know, we're all riding these trails together. We're all bros and sisters, basically. You know, it's I love going on trips, seeing just everyone smiling and hooting, hollering, skids and giggles. It's a good time out there.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of skids, obviously our pièce de résistance, the third of our closing question, in your personal opinion, in your heart of hearts, deep down there, tell me, please, what makes a great skid?
You know, Pascal, I really didn't want to tell anybody this, but what makes a great skid is a secret skid. So,
silent but deadly.
So if no one knows you did it, isn't it magic?
Well, with that, we close out the episode today. Thanks again, guys, for all the follow-up questions and inputs. Please keep them coming. They really help to make our podcast as relevant to our listeners as possible. Also, please keep sharing our episodes with your friends and writing buddies wherever you listen. It really helps us expand our reach and allows us to talk to many more cool and interesting people. Well, with that, see you later. Talk to you next time. Bye, Bryson.
Adios.
Adios.